This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
As well as feature presentations from members of Japan's Civil Society Organization. The discussion will be hosted by the Asia Society Museum and the Japan Foundation Center for Global Partnership from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., July 21st, 2011. The address is 725 Park Avenue at the corner of 70th Street, New York, New York, with free admission. For more information, log on to www.asiasociety.org.
It is 6 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. This is Wake Up Call. Sweet in the morning, indeed. Oh, sweet and humid in the morning. Good morning, New York. Tuesday, July 19th. I'm Esther Armour, Ife Dancy on engineering duties. Oof, my lord, the humidity, the sweat. Aren't we all dying this morning? You just need that water this morning. I thought I was going to just drip in a pool of water and end up at Utica Avenue subway in a heap. It is 79 degrees right now. The high today is 91 degrees, but the humidity is kicking in like a mother. That's all I can say. Coming up in our 6 o'clock hour, live to London, where a whistleblower who blew the lid off an illegal hacking scandal that is rocking British Parliament, the media, and the public was found dead in his home yesterday. Sean Hoare is the first journalist to have revealed that the tabloid news editor Andy Coulson was aware of phone hacking, and he was found in his home in Watford. His death comes after the resignation of London's top police chief, Sir Paul Stevenson, and his deputy, John Yates. And this morning, News International billionaire media mogul who owns the tabloids, Rupert Murdoch, will face a three-hour grilling in front of the House of Commons Culture Select Committee. Also being questioned, his son James Murdoch and a former chief executive who resigned and was arrested, Rebecca Brooks. As the illegal hacking scandal continues to unfold, we ask, might Rupert Murdoch himself step down? That speculation has begun. And what might happen to the British establishment if the scandal that reveals just how close ties are between politicians and the media mean that Murdoch's media empire may fall? We go live to London and speak with Wake Up Call regular Henry Bonsu, an independent journalist and also head of programming at Colourful Radio Station. Also, what happened at the United Nations talks last week, where a call was made to reduce the sale of arms in hostile territory by creating an arms trade treaty? Well, at the beginning of the talks, we spoke with Brian Wood, arms trade expert with Amnesty International, and he joins us again to share exactly what happened. And a call to action to tackle the proposed tuition hikes at CUNY proposed by the New York State Legislature. Student activists Domingo Estevez and Rocio Rayo join us with more. And with summertime, the humidity, what's best for your health, what's best for your stomach when it comes to food. WBAI's Natalie Tandaway, creator of the Yummy Cookbook, joins us to share her expert tips and to talk nutritional justice in the New York summertime. And we're in week two of WBAI's Summertime Fun Drive, and a wake-up call continues with that, coming up in the 7 and extended through into our 8 o'clock hour. It's all about eating right for cancer survival. In our two-DVD set, we bring you a special premium where physicians, nutritionists, and registered dietitians bring together their expertise as part of the Cancer Project to reveal how foods and nutrition impact, affect, and can fight cancer growth. And they also share the immune boosting foods to arm you with the tools to do the most for your body. Plus, you get all the recipes to make it easier. It's like taking a cooking class via a DVD and getting the kind of information that is unique to these airways. It's entertaining, it's proactive, it's yours. It's $100. It is Fun Drive. All of that and more coming up, but we start with local, national, and global news headlines. We say good morning to Wake Up Call's news editor, Christine Black. Morning, Christine.
Good morning, Esther. These are some of the day's headlines. Today, News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch faces questions from Parliament in the UK over the phone hacking scandal. His son James will also be questioned, as well as former News International head Rebecca Brooks. The scandal stems from claims that reporters at the now-closed British tabloid News of the World bribed police and hacked into the phones of approximately 4,000 people, including celebrities, politicians, and at least in one case, a crime victim. Reports that the phones of 9/11 victims were hacked has not yet been substantiated. Esther will have more on this story later in the program. Last Saturday, U.S. officials met with representatives of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, urging him to step down. This after the U.S. and other nations officially recognized the opposition National Transition Council as the legitimate Libyan government on Friday. The U.S. felt direct talks were necessary after Gaddafi allies reached out to American diplomats, wanting clarification on the U.S. position towards his remaining in power. The U.S. and NATO have been enforcing a no-fly zone in Libya after Gaddafi has threatened to retaliate against opposition protesters. And in Syria, at least 10 people have died during fighting in the city of Homs. In what might be the first sectarian violence of the uprising, majority Sunni Muslims clashed with minority Alawi, the ethnic group of President Bashar al-Assad, in a city where they are neighbors. In national news, the search continues for a compromise on a solution to the debt ceiling crisis. House Republicans are pushing forward a plan to amend the U.S. Constitution to require a balanced budget in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. Obama has said he would veto such a bill, and the measure would surely fail in the Senate. Meanwhile, in the Senate, a bipartisan team is working on a plan that would allow the president to raise the debt ceiling in three increments. The measure also includes modest spending cuts. This plan would be ready for a Senate vote by Saturday. And staffers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, worried informally about the risk of earthquakes for the nation's nuclear reactors. While most of the risk is in the West, there is new concern about plants in the Midwest and South. This after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan had a devastating impact on the nation's nuclear power plant network. The NRC has been looking into earthquake risks since 2005. The study isn't complete, but it points to a dozen reactors that might be at risk. The question is whether to force plant operators to spend millions on upgrades for relatively rare events. But recently a report suggested skipping cost-benefit analysis for a more science-based assessment of risk when deciding whether to do upgrades. In New Jersey, the legislature and Governor Christie are expected to negotiate the restoration of transitional aid to cities this week. The governor's line item vetoed all but $10 million out of $149 million in aid to the neediest cities, money that would help prevent some of the worst cuts to public safety and other services. Transitional aid not only pays for salaries, but it goes to pay off debt. Failing to pay would jeopardize the city's credit ratings, making it more difficult for them to borrow. The legislators tried to override the governor's vetoes last week, but failed along party lines. Yesterday in Connecticut, the state employees union voted to change their bylaws. Now the majority would win if a vote were taken on the concessions union leadership wanted to make with the governor to avert layoffs. Before, it took 80% to win approval, and the deal failed. Even though layoff notices have already gone out and announcements to service cuts were made, the governor and union leaders hope they can prevent the worst. Union leaders hope to have a revised agreement ready in the next few days so members can vote again. And finally, Mayor Bloomberg unveiled a traffic management system that would unsnarl Midtown gridlock at the push of a button. Using 100 motion detectors and dozens of cameras, along with info from EasyPass tags, traffic engineers can monitor the situation from Queens and coordinate traffic lights. The system will be deployed within a 110-block radius between 42nd and 57th Streets and 6th and 2nd Avenues. After 6 months, the Department of Transportation officials will decide whether to expand the system. And those are some of the headlines for today. You can send us your tips and comments to wbaiheadlines@gmail.com. Again, that's wbaiheadlines@gmail.com. Or call and leave a message specifically for Wake Up Call News headlines. Call 212-209-2815 to leave a comment. Again, that's 212-209-2815. Or tweet me at WBAI Headlines. Follow WBAI Headlines on Twitter for more information on today's stories. I'm Christine Black. Back to you, Esther.
Thank you, Christine. Here's Radio Roots, this radical day in history.
People, the time has come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 19th, in 1979,
the Sandinista National Liberation Front overthrew the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza Debayle. The U.S. had appointed his father as head of the newly established Nicaraguan National Guard in 1933, which had been established by the U.S. Marines as they withdrew from Nicaragua after 7 years of occupation. The Somoza family quickly took over the country, representing the wealthy Nicaraguan elite and U.S. interests for most of its corrupt 46-year reign, and violently squashing any political resistance by murdering thousands of citizens. Many members of the family were educated and received military training in the U.S. and regularly assisted the U.S. with imperialist political and military ventures in the region. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
As we move closer to the August 2nd deadline for the federal budget, the Republican-led House of Representatives is in negotiations with President Obama to decide what will be cut and what will be kept. Now, the House wants to balance the budget by cutting programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But President Obama and the majority of Democrats wants to focus on gaining revenue by raising taxes for large corporations and wealthier individuals. Now, according to critics of the Republicans' plan, cuts to the so-called safety net programs, that's how they're described, will be devastating because of their disproportionate impact on women and children. Joining me now to talk about that is Lisa Lynn Jacobs, Vice President for Government Relations at LegalMomentum.org. Lisa Lynn, good morning. Hi, welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning, Esther. Thank you for having me on.
And so lay this out for us, why you say there is a disproportionate impact that is devastating for women and children. Break it down.
Certainly. To begin with, let's talk about Social Security. And it's a disproportionate impact on women and children, but also the elderly, when you look at the intersection, particularly of Social Security and Medicare. In terms of both men and women who are older than 65, Social Security is their largest source of income. Women, however, rely on Social Security more heavily than men because men are more likely to have income from another source, like pensions or something like that. And even when women get pensions, they are more likely to have received less. They've either been in lower paying jobs or they've been in the workforce for a shorter period of time. So Social Security is a bigger chunk of their retirement package. On top of that, Social Security is something that people think of almost exclusively in the retirement context, but that's not exactly right. Social Security also functions as a safety net for women who are widowed and for children who have lost a parent. So if you are under 18, you receive Social Security benefits. As I was listening to the radio coming in this morning, the president has apparently said now that if the debt ceiling is not raised by August 3rd, he's not sure that the country is going to be able to make the next set of Social Security payments. So that's how dire this is for so many people who are relying on these particular sources of income.
So then let's talk numbers. How many people are we talking about who potentially might be impacted?
You know, I am happy to get back to you with those numbers, but clearly the one thing that we do know as an actuarial matter is that the country is aging. If you look at that cadre that people refer to as the baby boomers, people who are 65 and older, there are huge waves of people who are retiring now. So, and those are people who came of age in the 50s, as it were, or who were born in the 50s, excuse me. So we're not talking about an insignificant number of people by any stretch of the imagination. It is, you know, if you think of the pot-bellied pig in the python after the python swallows it, this cadre of retirees is bigger than any other age cadre of the United States population. And they're the ones who are going to be most immediately impacted.
And so do we have any other groups within the low-income housing or the food stamps, that section of the population would also be disproportionately impacted? If so, how?
Absolutely. I mean, because what we really are looking at is two different phenomena that are happening at the same time. At the same time that the leadership of both the House of Representatives and the Senate are in negotiations with the president, The more conservative end of the political spectrum is also pushing for something called a balanced budget amendment. And if that were passed, what that would do would be to either cap the amount of spending that would be allowed or to cause automatic cuts. And as devastating as proposed cuts to the budget are and have been, and they are, as we have been discussing, Social Security, but they are also other safety net programs like the food stamp program, like temporary assistance to needy families, which is a safety net program that primarily benefits single parents with children, like Medicare. All of these programs are implicated, and the huge tragedy of all this, quite obviously, is that we seem to be reduced to having this discussion about cutting this side of the budget, yet there is no willingness on the part of the more conservative elements to have a discussion about increasing revenue, which is as vital to this discussion as a discussion about reducing benefits.
And so, you know, we feel like we're in the middle of a standoff. We're hearing about showdowns between the Republicans and the president. It's been a daily kind of countdown. What's the latest exchange between one side and the other? But it doesn't feel like it's any closer to being resolved. So I know people feeling frustrated, feeling anxious. What can folks do?
I'm so happy that you asked that question. It is vital that everyone weigh in, not only with the White House, but with their members of Congress, both their congressional representatives and their senators, to make their views, whatever those are, known. You know, if you are a retiree or a veteran or someone else whose retirement or whose disability payments may be coming from the federal government, you need to make your voice heard. You know, something else that we've not talked about is the potential impact on school loans. You know, we keep talking about, the president particularly keeps talking about preparing the next generation as we come out of this recession, preparing the next generation to go into the workforce. If the federal government is not in a position to either provide student loans or guarantee them, there are people who are not going to be able to get the kinds of educational opportunities that are going to be necessary. So again, clearly everyone has a stake in this discussion, and everyone needs to be weighing in, both with the White House and with the Congress, about what their views are. It's the summer, so members of Congress are spending more time in their districts, whether or not it's over the weekend or during the week. I know that my representative, Jim Moran, in Northern Virginia just had a forum about, you know, people's concerns about the budget to allow them to weigh in. But members tend to be home, and, you know, they may be showing up at the county fair or someplace else. You know, make sure that you are calling your members and the White House to let them know what your views are and what your concerns are.
And so, say, for example, for argument's sake, let's just say there are no revenue increases in the package that is agreed to. Do you expect the Democrats will oppose it then?
You know, it's a very good question. I think that people on both sides, and rightfully so, are expressing concern about what's going to happen if we get to August 3rd. And there is no agreement. We certainly heard the minority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, putting forward his own proposals and expressing the concern that if there is a default, that the Republicans will be blamed. You cannot imagine that the Democrats are somehow less concerned about that. So I think it's a question of how far or how close to that deadline we're going to have to go before there is some kind of agreement. I am hopeful that in terms of being fiscally responsible, people will finally come to an agreement that includes both spending cuts and revenue increases. I am equally hopeful that no particular end of the political spectrum is going to end up having to, if you will, exclusively take the hit and not see some of their political philosophy reflected in what the ultimate deal is.
Because, you know, we see the thing is, when it comes really down to it, we don't care what the political fallout is. We want to know that those things, Medicare, Social Security, that they are protected. So let's put out there your magic wand. What would you want to see happen that doesn't so devastatingly, disproportionately impact women or children? What kind of budget would we need to see in order for that to happen?
You know, I think we would need to see a budget that first and foremost closes tax loopholes for oil companies and other businesses whose revenues have been quite healthy in this, you know, feeble economy. I think we also need to look at, you know, as I said, closing loopholes, other kinds of appropriate tax increases. You know, if you poll the American people and ask them if they think it's appropriate at this particular point to increase taxes for someone who is making $1 million or more, the answer is absolutely yes. We are bearing the brunt now of the impact of a set of tax cuts that were first put in place under President Bush. The combination of that and funding two wars is what has hemorrhaged all of this money out of the federal government. And I think the president certainly has put forth a plan both for downsizing the Pentagon and for wrapping up those war engagements. So the combination of doing that as soon as possible, but looking at appropriate revenue increases, whether or not it's closing loopholes for businesses or increasing taxes on those who are most able to bear it. Because when, you know, what we tend to not focus on, when we just start having an academic discussion about Social Security and Medicare, is that these are the people who have the least resources to fall back on. And so you're asking them to take the brunt of the hit in the context of these deficit talks without asking the people who clearly have the means to contribute more and will not be as adversely impacted. That, in my mind, is a travesty.
Lisa Lynn Jacobs, Vice President for Government Relations at LegalMomentum.org. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther.
6:21, you're listening to Wake Up Call. Now, the New York State Legislature has passed a bill that will mean tuition will go up every year for the next 5 years by $300. That's for university students. Now, the bill was supported by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, and it authorizes State University of New York, known as SUNY, and City University of New York, known as CUNY, to raise their education fees. The Ticker, a newspaper from Baruch College, reported that, quote, Assembly Higher Education Committee Chairwoman Deborah Glick proposed a separate tuition hike plan for CUNY schools that will allow a $200 increase over the span of a year and a $150 increase for the following 2 years, unquote. The executive committee of the CUNY Board of Trustees meets on Wednesday evening at 5 p.m. to consider these recommendations. Now, to talk to us more about the proposed tuition hikes and the action that's being taken to stop them, we're joined by one of the students from Student Unite CUNY. That's Domingo Estevez. Domingo, hi. Good morning. Welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you. So just explain to us this tuition bill. Every year for the next 5 years, tuition goes up by $300. Just break down for us, what does that mean for students?
Well, that means a lot of students who are already struggling to stay in school are most likely going to drop out. And they're not going to be able to pay the extra $300. And let's not forget the 10% that usually increase every semester by the Board of Trustees.
And talk to us about the recommendations that the CUNY Board of Trustees is actually considering.
Honestly, the recommendation is like you said, proposed by Barbara Glick. But I wouldn't know what could I expect from the Board of Trustees. You know, like most of these members took advantage of a free education, and just the fact that they keep increasing tuition on us seems kind of hypocritical, you know.
And so when we think about these tuition hikes, talk about the impact they'll have on the working class, lower income students at City University at CUNY.
Well, City University at CUNY was looked at the poor man's Harvard, you know, and it's looking like it's going to turn into Harvard, you know, out of reach for the working class who is supposed to be attending this school system.
And so that City University was seen as a poor man's Harvard. That's deep.
Yeah.
And so is there any kind of corresponding increase in, say, financial aid that would help those same students to meet the costs of an increased education at CUNY?
Well, I haven't really heard any talks about that. All I hear is about cuts to TAP. I would say the Pell Grant. We can't go to school during the summer, I believe. I don't even know. It seems like if they're trying to filter the educational system out of out of working class, I guess, students, you know, students of the working class.
Okay, and so talk about the kind of response there has been to these proposed hikes from students in the university. What kind of outcry has there been?
Well, as tuition content keeps increasing, you can see how like, for example, last semester, just with the, I believe it's a 5 to 10% increase that the Board of Trustees implements, two of my friends are not going to be able to come back in the fall, you know. And that's not even talking about the $300 a year proposed tuition increase. So it's just basically going to just break the backs of the students who are actually going to work and paying for school. Because it's already hard as it is. And yet you're asking them for more and more and more instead of saying, here, keep going to school. Here, like, instead of helping them out, you know.
And what kind of reaction have you had from the faculty bodies, like the Faculty Student Senate and the PSC at CUNY?
Well, the PSC has been very helpful. The student faculty, I don't know what's going on with the students right now. Like, I don't know what's it going to take in order for us to really start saying enough is enough. But I started researching into the past, and it's not like it's impossible. Back in 1989, Cuomo's father proposed the same tuition increase for the following 5 years. There was a little scuffle between students and, I would say, the state, and they bring it down from 500 to 300. But the fact that this legislation was vetoed goes to show that it's not impossible for us to stop this tuition hike. It's been stopped before. You know, now it's the sun's turn to get it stopped.
Mm. And so you're saying that at the moment you're feeling that the students are really not showing the kind of outcry and call to action that is needed to really bring this up on the radar of more folks.
Well, the steps I think that were taken to pass this legislation, I think students will start noticing the fact that they pass legislations like this in the summer when all of us are probably on vacation or enjoying our summer. And that goes to show, like, they used the equal marriage bill, I believe it was, to basically just cover up that tuition increase vote.
And so talk about the kind of action that you're proposing and what you're calling on supporters to do to fight this.
I would say we're more focused on educating the misinterpretations that students have towards, like, these tuition increases and the fact that they need to increase tuition in order for CUNY to keep a bit, to sustain itself. I would say it's more like of educating students and then moving towards creating big campaigns to basically stop these tuition increases, these tuition hikes, and more of a, I would say education is the main purpose right now. Let them know that there are several possibilities. There is a possibility to have a free CUNY once again as it was prior to 1976.
So do you feel there's just a sense in which the students are not fully aware of the history that CUNY has had and the kind of activism history that it's had, and not knowing that is keeping them from being more outraged or moving to protest in a more overt way?
Yeah, of course. I know they would feel outraged to know that once we minorities were the majority in CUNY, that's when they started implementing tuition. The fact that open admissions has been basically wiped out of CUNY already, you know. So it's like just educating them about the real facts of what's really happened in CUNY. And I would say once they understand that, then they'll probably have a different look and different approaches to basically the CUNY struggle.
And so coming to you personally, Domingo, if this hike had been in place, you're a student at CUNY right now, what would that have meant for your own education?
At the moment, I'm getting financial aid. So financial aid is most likely to cover it. The way I see it is that we're actually, if we don't do anything about this, most of us might graduate, But the fact is, think about the future. Like, do our kids really have a chance with the way the market is? Tuition increased by $300. That's for the next 5 years. That's $1,500 right there. Like, so school's going to be $1,500 more expensive for kids that are coming in the future. You know, financially, they're probably going to need to take out loans to be in a community college, and that's outrageous. Mm. You know?
So can you foresee a time where essentially it would change the makeup of the diversity of the students that even go to CUNY, because it would price certain folks totally out of that educational market?
Of course. I think most likely that's the target of it.
And And so moving forward, if folks would like to get more information and find out more about this challenge and this battle, where can they go to do that? Is there a website or a number or an email you can give out?
Yeah, we have a website. It's called studentsforafreecuny.com. That's studentsunitedforafreecuny.com, I'm sorry.
So the website is studentsunitedforafreecuny.com?
Yeah.
All one word?
Yes.
So www.studentsunitedforafreecuny.com.
Yeah, that's our blog. What we do there is basically give our visitors basically a blast from the past, information from the past movements, you know, just informing them that there is a possibility, you know, that we do have a chance. It's just the fact of empowering ourselves and moving forward together as one.
Wise words indeed. Domingo Estevez, student with Students Unite at CUNY, fighting those tuition hikes. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. 6:32. You're listening to Wake Up Call. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. We go live to London now. A tabloid journalist responsible for blowing the whistle on the illegal hacking scandal that is rocking London and the establishments of media and politics was found dead at his home yesterday. Sean Hoare was the former News of the World show business reporter and was the first named journalist to allege that editor Andy Coulson was aware of phone hacking by his staff. Hoare worked on The Sun, another tabloid newspaper, and the News of the World with Coulson, and was found at his home in Watford. Now, this is the latest on the hacking scandal where Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Paul Stevenson and now his deputy, Paul Yates, have both resigned. The billionaire media mogul and chairman of News International, Rupert Murdoch, will face a grilling in front of a select House of Commons Culture Committee today in London. And also facing the committee is his son, James Murdoch, and former chief executive, Rebecca Brooks. So we now go live to London for the latest on the scandal that is really unmasking the British power elite and revealing how close the ties are between politicians, media, and government. And what will happen to those ties with this on the unveiling of the scandal? And also, there is already started speculation about the possibility that Rupert Murdoch himself may step down. Is that just cable news chatter? We're going to talk about all of that and get the latest as we go live to London. We're joined by journalist and head of programming at Colourful Radio, closely following the story for Wake Up Call, Henry Bonsu. Henry, morning. Hi. Good morning.
Morning to you, Esther. Believe me, I am following this very closely. I've been a journalist for 20 years, and I love events, and this is one of the biggest. People are queuing now, desperate to get seats for the public gallery. The MPs are being tipped. They're being briefed. The newspapers are full of questions and advice for them, the questions they need to pose to stop the Murdochs and Rebecca Brooks, and also the police officers, because remember, there are two committees sitting, one, the culture, media, and sport. They're the ones who are interviewing the Murdochs and Rebecca Brooks, of course, who resigned last week. And then we have the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is interviewing those two now former very senior Met police officers. So the stakes could not be higher, and people have been building up to this for the last few days. People are very, very excited to hear what they will say.
And it seems like every day there's a new revelation regarding this scandal. Let's just go back and talk a little bit about Sean Hoare, the first whistleblower that really revealed this illegal hacking scandal, I guess, along with Hugh Grant. Tell us a bit more about him.
That's right. I mean, he's a troubled man. The News of the World got rid of him some years ago and amid allegations that he was an alcoholic, he had problems with drugs. But, of course, he came back to prominence last September when he gave that interview to the News of the World and contradicted his former boss, Andy Coulson, by saying this man knew of the industrial-scale phone hacking and had actually authorized it and suggested to reporters that they engage in this practice. Direct contradiction because, of course, he, Coulson, said that he never knew what was going on, and that's one reason why the Prime Minister, David Cameron, hired him first as his press spokesman and his director of communications when he was opposition leader, and then retained him in the post against quite a significant number of advisers and indeed the Guardian opponents who told him, look, this man is in it up to his neck. But Cameron has said last week, look, I thought he should be given a second chance. Now, if it can be shown that he was lied to or that he was naive and accepted this man on his word, and that what Sean Hoare said about Andy Coulson was right, then Cameron will look very foolish indeed. And the odds are shortening on Cameron having to step down as Prime Minister way before his time.
So David Cameron may have to step down because...
Well, here's what's being said. People are saying that Cameron...
David Cameron is the Prime Minister, by the way.
David Cameron, of course, is at best naive, at worst arrogant and foolish. A man who refused to think there was any risk in bringing into his, I suppose, into his home, into number 10 Downing Street, into the heart of government, a man of whom it's now being said was at the heart of an industrial-scale phone hacking scandal. A man whose newspaper was hacking the phones of victims here in this country and possibly abroad. A man who may have been consorting with criminals. A man who it looks as though may be arrested again. Remember, we've had a number of arrests in the past few days. Andy Coulson was arrested. Of course, last week he was detained for about 9 hours. Rebecca Brooks was arrested on Monday, and she was in detention for about 12 hours. Les Hinton, the former chief executive of News Corp's financial news service, the Dow Jones, publisher, of course, of the Wall Street Journal, he has resigned. There's been a number of resignations in the past few days, apart from the police, and the net is closing in. There are an awful lot of former News International journalists, News International executives, who must be feeling very, very ill at ease at the moment. But also, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, of course, he's getting dragged further and further into this. He was in South Africa yesterday talking to President Zuma, talking to the African community from South Africa, and now he's in Nigeria talking about free trade and, of course, supposedly talking about corruption and the need for government to be good and decent, talking about free trade. But, of course, all the time the questions the journalists are asking him are to do with what's going here. So as a result of that, he's cut short what was supposed to be a 5-day trip across several countries in Africa, and now he's coming back later today, having visited just two of those countries.
That's quite extraordinary that this may impact the Prime Minister to that degree. It makes me wonder, with the Lib Conservative, with the Lib Dem Conservative pact as head of government, what might that mean? Just for our listeners, in the last election, the Conservatives did not win a clear majority. So they, together with the Liberal Democrats, I guess we would call them the Independents,
yep,
formed an alliance in order that they would run the country together, which has caused all kinds of challenges and problems because, of course, the Conservatives equivalent to the Republicans and the Lib Dems equivalent to the Independents. So that's the coalition government, that's what it's called, that's running the country. So this scandal hits Cameron and his government even harder, since we're expected to hear
very
from
much so, Esther.
Well, that's really quite extraordinary.
It is, and one of the reasons why David Cameron's coming under such pressure is because in his parting shot, in his resignation statement, the erstwhile Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police Service, the most senior police officer in this country, said, well, the Metropolitan Police, hired Neil Wallace, a former senior News of the World journalist, i.e. the deputy to Andy Coulson while he was there. We hired Neil Wallace, who did not resign as a result of phone hacking, whereas the Prime Minister hired Andy Coulson, a man who did resign, inviting people to draw comparisons with his own situation, i.e. I myself, Sir Paul Stevenson, have resigned because the newspapers keep on linking me to a gentleman, the deputy to Andy Coulson. That particular deputy, Neil Wallace, who was my press advisor, did not resign. However, I have been forced to resign. The
wow.
Prime Minister who hired him, he also hired his boss, Andy Coulson, who did resign as a result of phone hacking allegations. Well, what is his position now? So I'm interpreting it in a bit more graphic detail, but the newspapers have done the same, and they're saying now that this senior police officer is so angry, he's furious that he's been forced to step down, furious that he wasn't given explicit backing from Downing Street, furious that he wasn't given explicit backing from the Home Secretary or from the Mayor, Boris Johnson. And we should say a little bit about Neil Wallace, the former deputy editor of the News of the World. He has a PR company which was given a contract at £1,000 a day to advise the Metropolitan Police Commissioner. Now, he was given that contract shortly after the Metropolitan Police decided there was no need to reopen the closed investigation into phone hacking allegations. The person who took that decision was John Yates, who resigned yesterday. John Yates is a very good friend of Neil Wallace.
Oh,
both
wow.
The Met Commissioner, Sir Paul Stevenson, and the erstwhile Deputy Assistant Commissioner, John Yates, were on very good terms with Neil Wallace. They met him and dined with him on many occasions.
Wow.
Sir Paul Stevenson, when he was convalescing from a precancerous growth early this year, took 5 weeks of hospitality from an elite, very, very nice resort called Champagne's. Guess who the PR officer of Champagne's was? Neil Wallace. So these things have conspired together to make the Met Commissioner's position untenable and to make John Yates' position untenable. Both of those guys, two of the most senior policemen in Britain, will go before the Home Affairs Select Committee to give an account of themselves. And, of course, shortly after that, at about 2:30 UK time, 9:30 in the morning your time, let the games begin. Because Rupert Murdoch, James Murdoch, and Rebecca Brooke, their former employee, will be hauled before the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee to answer questions, key questions, and the papers are full of these. For James Murdoch, why did you pay up to £2 million to victims of phone hacking? And then, if Andy Coulson, Les Hinton and Rebecca Brooks had to resign, even when they claim to be ignorant of wrongdoing on their watch, why don't you do the same? Question for Rupert Murdoch, key question, when did you become aware of phone hacking at the News of the World and payment to victims? And then also, last week, remember, he said his company had handled the crisis very well. Yet at the weekend, he apologized, spending a lot of money in national newspapers. Why the change of heart? And then Rebecca Brooks, now ex-editor of The Sun and The News of the World and former chief exec of the News International Group. How can you credibly claim to have known nothing of phone hacking? And then in 2003, you'll have seen these clips, Esther, you admitted paying police officers. How many have your papers paid? How much have you paid, and over what period? And then how often did you meet David Cameron in the year before he became Prime Minister? Remember, since this scandal blew up, David Cameron has decided to do a bit of glasnost and openness, yep? And what he's done, he's revealed the number of times he has met senior News International executives since he became Prime Minister 15 months ago. You know how many times, Esther? 26. People are saying, this is very wrong.
Wow, so this could potentially bring down the Prime Minister. So then, might it potentially bring down Murdoch too?
Well, this is the thing. I don't think anything that happens here will bring Murdoch down. What could bring Rupert Murdoch down is what happens in the United States with that FBI investigation, with those senior senators and congressmen and congresswomen, women like Barbara Boxer, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And congressmen like Pete King. These are people who had the power to trigger further investigations and further inquiries. The FBI are looking into News Corporation and its activities. Has it suborned police officers to break the law, to hack into people's phone messages, the victims of 9/11 or their relatives? These are the kind of things that will persuade shareholders that maybe Rupert Murdoch is no longer fit to be chairman and chief executive of the News Corporation Group.
What a dirty pot of tra-la-la, as we would say,
yes,
back
indeed.
Home.
Yes, indeed. Tra-la-la, indeed.
Wow. Okay, so then, given all of this mess that is literally becoming a bigger mess each and every day, the question that it raises for me is that these close ties between the politicians, the media, and the government, and the extent to which there was this incestuous, intertwined relationship. What does that mean? We had Tony Benn on with us yesterday, and I was asking him, what does he think it means for democracy, that the public is learning the degree to which you had the politicians in bed with the media, in bed with the government, in bed with the police. Like, this was a polygamous union, man.
Absolutely. It really was, Esther. And people are looking at this and the emperor has no clothes. People are saying, is this how our society, our country is really run? The degree of incestuousness. Because, of course, when it gets really serious, because people are tolerant of this to a degree, because, you know, people do favors for each other. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Yeah.
But what they don't like is when this nepotism becomes criminal. It gets to the point where maybe investigations are not pursued. And this is the key allegation in this whole drama. The police went easy, went soft on News International, closed down investigations, even though The Guardian, the left-wing newspaper, was telling them, look, there is a case to answer. There are more than just Clive Goodman, the former royal reporter who was jailed, and Glenn Mulcair, the private investigator at the center of all of this, the one who had 11,000 documents with details of people's phone numbers, PIN numbers, home address, etc. Why were those 11,000 documents not looked at again, afresh? Why did they lie empty, rotting in bin bags without so much as a care from the Metropolitan Police? Is it because they were having lunches, taking hospitality from the News of the World? Is one of the reasons why the Conservative Party did not, why they did not push the police, because they too were supping from the trough of News International. And when it shows that it might interfere with justice, when also people who've been victims of crime have come forward and told the police anonymously about what's happened to them. Rape victims, there was a case, Esther, where a rape victim came forward to the police to talk about what happened to her. Her information was given to journalists who ended up putting it in the newspaper. She then faced death threats. She had to go in hiding. Now,
I just want to stop you. See, this is why this is interesting, because Rupert Murdoch owns the New York Post.
Yeah.
And in the New York Post, there were major revelations about the Dominique Strauss-Kahn allegations of sexual assault and information about that victim that just appeared in the Post. She's now suing the Post, and they are owned by Murdoch and News International.
Absolutely. This is a pattern of behavior. Now, the question is how far it goes across the Atlantic. And also here, Esther, let's be honest, there are other newspapers, there are other tabloids, many of them trying to jump into the grave of the News of the World on Sunday, all saying, we're the paper you can trust, offering lots more sex, celebrity and titillation, because there are 7 million readers who are looking for a newspaper now on a Sunday in Britain.
Wow. Wow, this is extraordinary.
See the extent of this.
It's extraordinary, and the extent it gets deeper and deeper. Are we expecting potentially any more resignations? Like, how much deeper does can the dirt go?
Well, we could have other resignations. Who knows? James Murdoch himself may resign, I suspect. Yeah. The old digger himself, as he's called, Rupert Murdoch, will not resign. He'll fight tooth and nail to remain at the head of that company because he wants to ensure a legacy. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, the two top police officers in this whole drama have stepped down. The rest of them, like Andy Heyman, have retired. And that's what police officers in this country often do when they're caught in the eye of the storm. They step down, and then usually investigations into them internally are stopped. They're halted straight away. This is a tradition here in this country, and it often means justice is not served. But there is something called the Independent Police Complaints Commission, which can investigate police officers even after they have stepped down, ostensibly to evade justice. We have to wait and see what happens. But the big fish in all of this, of course, is the Prime Minister. What will happen? Now, a week or so ago, he was saying that Andy Coulson was and still is a friend. In fact, it was revealed, due to freedom of information, that Andy Coulson spent the night at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country retreat, just in March. Presumably because he's still a friend. But last week, the Prime Minister appeared to throw him to the wolves when he said, if Andy Coulson has lied and has said untruths, then, of course, he must face the full might of the law and go to jail, possibly, if it warrants it. So there we are. People are twisting and turning each way, trying desperately to protect their reputations. The other newspapers as well, like the Daily Mail, which is, of course, on the serious right of politics here in this country, it has been revealed, and this is something that's been known for some time, to have used private investigators with abandon. The question is whether those private investigators also broke the law by phone hacking. Did the Daily Mail pay police officers for information? Well, their editor-in-chief, Paul Dacre, a very mighty man in newspapers here in this country, he's feared and revered by politicians everywhere, he has said no. But you can be sure that there will be people in other newspapers investigating what they've done. They could be next.
So could this Murdoch gate be for David Cameron what Watergate was for Nixon, potentially?
Well, who knows? I mean, look, we've got a dead journalist now, dead ex-journalist. Suspicious circumstances. Now, the police claim, they said very, very quickly, that this appears to be a death. Well, no, well, they claimed it wasn't suspicious. The blogosphere is going crazy. Twitter is going crazy. People are making comparisons with David Kelly, the former weapons inspector, who blew the whistle, initially anonymously, but was then outed in 2003 and then took his own life. People, the conspiracy theorists, went into overdrive. They're now going into overdrive about Sean Hoare, saying, well, did somebody kill him? Where was Andy Coulson at the time? Now, serious people are not going too far with this, but it does make people scratch their heads and just wonder what it was that happened to this particular man at this time. Because believe you me, the police would have been wanting to question him again. This is the situation. When people start taking their lives, if that's what's happened, or something more sinister, then it gets very, very serious indeed.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to come back to you again because, of course, we know that the Murdochs are testifying in front of the committee today. There's the Home Affairs Select Committee today, Rebecca Brooks, James Murdoch and Rupert Murdoch all testifying, as are the former police commissioner and his deputy, Saul Stevenson and Mr. Yates. And so we're going to continue with our coverage, but for now, live from London, hot on this trail, keeping us absolutely informed and up to the minute with clarity and concise analysis, Henry Bonsu. We certainly appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Esther, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you so much. 6:51, this is Wake Up Call. Now, summertime in New York City, and with the humidity, the temperature staying healthy as well as keeping cool. So what might be the food tips and health tips to make that all of our reality? To talk nutritional justice in the New York summertime, we're going to be joined by Natalie Tandiway, host of WBAI's Women, Body and Soul, but also the creator of the Yummy Cookbook and DVD, Delicious, Healthy and Affordable Meals Without Meat, Dairy, Wheat or soy and nut free. Natalie, morning. Hi, welcome to Wake Up Call.
Good morning, Esther. Good morning, New York.
And so this is the big question. It is it's so humid. We're getting so dehydrated, and sometimes you feel like your blood sugar drops, and you're jonesing for something sweet, but you want to try and stay healthy because sometimes the sweet stuff doesn't actually necessarily quench your thirst. So let's do both things to drink that keep your thirst quenched and keep us hydrated, as well as the foods that we really should be aiming for at this time of year.
This is such a great question. Yes, it is. It's like an oven out here during the day. I want people to start by thinking about how much water they should drink, you know, in addition to just the particular food. One of the things to think about is that the Food and Nutrition Board advises that adult women consume 91 ounces of water daily, and that adult men consume 125 ounces daily. And this is a lot more water than people traditionally talk about drinking. In the past, it's been, get eight-ounce glasses of water a day. So I just want to start there with getting people thinking about...
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot of water. Are you drinking enough water? Now, remember, you can get some of that water through your food. So that's going to be part of what we talk about. But I also want to mention children. Of course, you want to consult your child's pediatrician their recommendations, particularly if your child has any illnesses or is taking any medications. But in the meantime, an easy way to estimate how many ounces of water a child needs is to take their body weight and you can multiply it by, take their body weight and about anywhere from one-third to one-half of their body weight should equal about how many ounces you need. So let's say your kid weighs 60 pounds. So half of 60 pounds is 30. So that would be about 30 ounces. So, you know, that's one really easy way to calculate, am I getting enough water into my child?
And so what's that? I'm trying to think of, you know, when you think of the liters of water that you buy in the store, what is for an adult woman or for a child, what's the equivalent?
Great. That 91 ounces mm-hmm. is nearly 3 liters.
Wow.
And that 125 ounces is nearly 4 liters. So, so you're talking about a couple of liters if you're looking at a 60-pound child. But remember, you don't have to get all of your hydration through water. You can also get it through your food, through vegetables, through fruits, and we're talking about that today.
Mm-hmm.
But I like people to have a baseline idea of how much water they're trying to get into their body. And remember, hydration isn't just about water. It's also about minerals. And that's why people talk about electrolytes and electrolyte drinks, and this is why food is so important, because hydration is about that balance of water and electrolytes that your body needs to function. Now, electrolytes are just minerals. They happen to be minerals that are electrically charged, like sodium, calcium, potassium, magnesium, but they're very important for your body chemistry and for your muscle function and metabolism. And that's why that food is so important, because that food is going to give you water, but it's also going to give you electrolytes.
So then if I'm having my, I tend to, like, at 12 noon, I go for my salad, my lettuce, my tomatoes.
Excellent.
I'm an avocado freak. I like some baked fish. And that's what I'm going to kind of throw on a plate. Is that the type of thing? Am I kind of moving in the right direction? Does that give me a good amount of water in the food as well?
Yes, you're going there. Think about things like soups, broth, things like that, to actually get the liquids.
Right.
And when you think about the electrolytes, you want to look at, celery, cucumbers, if you're looking at veggies, especially if you're thinking about salads, but also fruits like watermelon, papaya, cantaloupe, peaches, strawberries, a wonderful amount of electrolytes. Even bananas, even though they're not particularly hydrating, have a lot of potassium in them. But I also want to remind people, particularly those people who are from the tropics and probably realize this already, coconut water has a fantastic amount of electrolytes and a great balance of actual water to electrolytes. So that's even something that some athletes and runners will use instead of one of those sports drinks with all the food coloring and all of that. Just throwing back some coconut water can get you there as well.
Coconut water is delicious as well. And it gives you that sugar rush because it's sweet. So it gives you, if you have the natural stuff, not the stuff that's loaded with all the crap.
Exactly.
And so, so then you can rock a smoothie in the morning that will get you your fruits if you can't do the actual fruit salad, because some mornings I can't do the fruit. But you know what I often fancy in the morning is oatmeal still with fruit and soy milk. And so if you're gonna kind of move away from the salads and have some hot food, what can you do that still maintains that good, healthy nutritional balance?
I would say soups, because you can get a lot of veggies into your soups, and they also have a lot of water in them. So they're hydrating, they're nutritive, and you can get some of those electrolytes in them. And also it's summertime, so remember cold soups like gazpacho, things like that are really easy to do, as well as fruit-based soups.
But what do you do if you're like me, you're a rice chick? Like, I just got to have rice at some point in the day. do you know what I mean? And
fine.
Soup doesn't feel meaty sometimes. Like, you don't feel like you've already had a meal.
Well, add some rice to the soup. I mean, that's a really simple way to do some of that. But there's nothing wrong with still eating food. You're hydrating. You're not starving yourself.
True.
So it doesn't have to be an either or. You can still have your rice. It's just that you want to remember to have your rice in moderation, which is a conversation that you would be having even if you weren't talking about hydration.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And it's weird how sometimes you have incredible hunger for very specific foods when it gets really, really hot, and you jones just for that food. And then other times your appetite goes completely, particularly when the humidity hits, and no amount of liquid seems to quench your thirst. And it feels like you're just oozing water from just every part of your body. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it could also be that your body's actually looking for more electrolytes, more minerals. So that's where something like having a few pieces of vegetable or fruit that's got a really high balance of electrolytes, like the watermelon or the papaya or the celery or cucumbers, can help. But also you want to start by, anytime you're really hungry, you want to start eating by drinking. And by drinking something that doesn't have any sugar in it, preferably a water or a tea, something like that, because you want to start hydrating your body.
Yeah, no, that's true, because you always end up eating really, really fast, whereas actually I'm often dehydrated, and that's part of it.
We all are. It's really hard for most of us to get enough water. And so just remember, some of those signs of dehydration, by the time you're thirsty, it's too late. That means you're really dehydrated.
Wow.
If you're having muscle cramps or spasms, if you have dry skin or dry lips, or you're experiencing constipation, these are all kinds of little signs that your body is not getting enough water.
Wow. So So keep that hydration. And especially on the subway, oof, you definitely need that because you just feel like you're going to pass. They freak out, like just lay out on that subway.
And you want to remember to actually keep water with you and keep water where you work. It sounds so simple, but it's really easy to forget. And also, when it's hot like this, throw water in the freezer. So, have one that you're drinking and one that's going to come out of the freezer if you're like ice cold water when you're hot.
And so let folks know, we know that you have the Yummy Cookbook that offers us all these delicious recipes, the Yummy Cookbook and DVD, delicious, healthy and affordable meals without meat, dairy, wheat or soy and nut free. So is there a website, Facebook page, information where
Amazon,
folks can get more information?
It's all on Amazon. The Yummy Cookbook and DVD are both available on Amazon. Thank you so much for asking.
That's okay. So that you can get, I know from experience, some of the stuff is too tasty to be that healthy, but I thank the Lord that it is that healthy. It's called the Yummy.
It really is.
Yeah, no, it really is. The Yummy Cookbook and DVD, delicious, healthy, and affordable meals without meat, dairy.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.